Hello, I'm Manuela Zaragoza. Welcome to Business Daily. Coming up, how should bosses deal with mental health issues at work? Do they have a right to know, or is it the responsibility of employees to tell?
Media and business have a fundamental role to play. The media in how we talk about and discuss these issues, and business in being big enough and brave enough to say, I'm not going to buy into the stereotypes.
Also, sexism in the US tech industry. Is anyone leaning in?
Women in Silicon Valley are doomed. That's one of the comments I heard at a recent gathering of female executives here in Silicon Valley.
That's all coming up in Business Daily from the BBC. What motivated co-pilot Andreas Lubitz to deliberately fly a German Wings plane into the French Alps last week, killing himself and all the other 149 passengers on board? It's a question German prosecutors are still trying to answer. Speculation has been rife over whether mental illness played a role. That's led to more questions about how mental health should be treated in the workplace. Well, Alistair Campbell used to be the chief spokesman and strategist for the former British Prime Minister Tony Blair. He suffered a breakdown in the 1980s before he took his job with Tony Blair. These days, he campaigns on mental health issues in the UK and has just published a book about the mindset of people who lead successful political and sporting careers, a book called Winners. I asked him how he'd managed to juggle his illness with the pressure of his work for Tony Blair.
For me, the most important thing was openness and honesty. Now, that's very difficult for a lot of people. I was lucky to have a great doctor, I had a good family, a good boss, good colleagues. I never hid it. I was also lucky because when I first started working for Tony Blair, the media started to write about my breakdown, which they'd all known about because I was a journalist, and it was of no interest to anybody when I was a journalist, but suddenly I became interesting in their eyes and they started to write about it, and I made the decision to be open, and that was, for me, that was a good thing. However, I understand why people aren't open, because there still is this massive stigma and taboo surrounding it.
Do you think an employer has a right to know about someone's mental health? Do you think that that is essential?
I think it would be helpful. However, you see, the reason why this stigma exists is because people feel that other people won't understand. They feel that about relatives, they feel that about their boss, they feel that about their colleagues. And, of course, this media coverage just exacerbates that. So in an ideal world, yes, an employer has a right to know. Just as an employer has a right to know whether you are physically fit, if your job requires physical activity. But I do understand why somebody might hold that back. In an ideal world, somebody ought to be able to say, well, actually, I'm on antidepressants at the moment because I've had a bad bout of depression 6 months ago. Or they might be, they ought to be able to say, well, you see that gap in my CV 15 years ago when I had 6 months where there doesn't appear to be much there. That's because I was actually in rehab because I was a drug addict. Now, people don't do that. Now, actually, I have met employers.
But can I say that people don't do that also because I suppose the issue with mental illness is that it's very difficult to draw a distinct line between someone's personality and someone's illness. The lines are so much more blurred. In that way, it's so much worse than any other illness because you can't always separate the person from the illness as easily as you can with other physical ailments.
There may be something in that. But you see, the book I've written, I've actually written a lot in there about, it's about winners, but because of my campaign and work on mental health, I have sort of woven in stories about mental illness. And the reality is that if you think of some of the greatest people in history, most Americans say Abraham Lincoln was their greatest ever president. Most British people say that Winston Churchill was our greatest ever prime minister. Most people in the scientific community say that Charles Darwin was one of the greatest figures in scientific thinking. Most people in medicine would say that Florence Nightingale and Marie Curie. Now, they are five of the greatest people in history. All had what today we would define as mental illness.
You told Tony Blair about your condition before you took the job.
I did, yeah.
Do you think that that's what, that responsibility, I mean, we spoke about the responsibility of the employer, the right of the employer to know, but do you think that there is also a responsibility on the employee to inform their employer?
They should be in this ideal world that doesn't exist.
Maybe they shouldn't even be working, or they should say it, and if the reaction is bad, they shouldn't even be working for an employer that doesn't understand.
I agree with
that.
I have said to people, if you've got an employer that you don't trust to tell, then they're not worth working for. That's easy for me to say, because I'm pretty well off. I've got loads of opportunities. I can make money doing... I can make more money making a speech than some people earn in a year. It's ridiculous on one level. So if you're a teacher, or you're a nurse, or you're going for your first job interview, I completely understand why people wouldn't tell. However, the reason why I found the coverage of this Lubitz situation so offensive is because it's setting us back. It's reinforcing these attitudes that slowly we're trying to change. You know, we are doing better on some level. And I was in Ghana last year looking at mental health services there, and, you know, it was pretty upsetting. Their services and their understanding compared to ours, we're a long way ahead, but we're still way behind where we need to be. And the media and business have a fundamental role to play. The media in how we talk about and discuss these issues, and business in being big enough and brave enough to say, I'm not going to buy into the stereotypes, and actually encourage people to be honest and say it won't be held against you.
Do you genuinely think that stigma can be overcome?
This may sound a bit over the top, I don't know. I don't think it is. I think this is the last really big taboo in our world. I think racial equality, there's been still not there, but massive progress. Women's rights, massive progress. And I think mental health is kind of 5, 10, 15, 20, 30, 50, 100 years behind that, depending where you live in the world.
That was Alistair Campbell, Tony Blair's former chief spokesman. You're listening to Business Daily from the BBC with me, Manuela Saragossa. Well, Alistair Campbell spoke there of progress on women's rights. Well, there is a perception that women are still not being treated as equals in the tech industry in the US, even though the industry itself considers itself a vanguard of the future. It all came to a head recently in Ellen Powell's gender discrimination case against her former employer, Kleiner, Perkins, Caulfield and Byers, a Silicon Valley venture capital firm. She lost her case last week. Despite that, it's highlighted concerns about the lack of diversity in the technology sector in the US. So just how bad is it? Over to our commentator, Alison van Diggelen in Silicon Valley.
Women in Silicon Valley are doomed. That's one of the comments I heard at a recent gathering of female executives here in Silicon Valley. It came from a manager who spent 20 years working in human resources. She and her colleagues described the double standard they witnessed at tech firms. Women being passed over for promotion, paid less than men, and treated as second-class citizens. Last year, major tech companies like Google, Facebook, and LinkedIn published their diversity figures, which underline the sad fact that, at best, 15% of their tech engineering teams are female. The number of women choosing to study computer science is now half of what it was in the 80s. It's hard to find a woman in Silicon Valley tech who hasn't experienced some biased treatment at work because of her sex. Women are expected to be agreeable, generous collaborators and always look good. One female executive talked about traditional expectations. We're supposed to be at home nuzzling newborns, she said. Why does all this matter? Gender imbalance in tech is a problem for everyone and needs to be tackled for three vital reasons: innovation, competitive advantage, and the bottom line. Studies show the more diverse your team, the more innovative it is. Since Silicon Valley's whole modus operandi is innovation and inventing the future, making tech firms more diverse should be a no-brainer. Given tech companies are making products for a diverse world population, the more teams are representative of their market, the more chance they'll make consumer-pleasing products and gain a competitive advantage. There's also a correlation between the number of female executives and success rates of companies. A recent study by the Kauffman Foundation found that companies with the highest representation of women in their top management achieved better financial performance than other companies. As Hillary Clinton said at a recent Silicon Valley conference, inclusivity is more than a buzzword, it's a recipe for 21st century success. The fact that companies are coming out about their diversity stats and acknowledging there's a problem is a great first step, but more should be done. Facebook, LinkedIn and the Anita Borg Institute recently announced a partnership to support female tech students at college and increase the number of women joining the tech ranks. The pipeline issue is crucial. Encouraging more women to choose computer science at college will help reverse current trends. Megan Smith, America's Chief Technology Officer, is right when she says mandatory computer science needs to start in second grade. But it's going to take strong leadership within companies to help bolster these efforts and provide an inclusive environment that's both welcoming to women and gives them the respect and the opportunities they deserve. LinkedIn's Jeff Weiner says that with two young daughters, gender imbalance is now a personal issue for him. He and other Silicon Valley leaders must commit to real change for the long term. No, women in Silicon Valley tech are not doomed. I'm hopeful that the Valley will mature and get beyond this ugly adolescent phase. Alison Van Diggelen of Fresh Dialogues for the BBC World Service in Silicon Valley.
Well, it was one of Silicon Valley's most high-profile women who advised female colleagues that the only way to be treated as an equal was to lean in. That advice came from Sheryl Sandberg, Facebook's chief operating officer, in her eponymous book, which she described as a sort of feminist manifesto. The book has since sold over 2 million copies worldwide, and it's been translated into 38 languages. One measure of its influence is the global network now of lean-in circles. These small in-person and online peer group meetings have cropped up within companies, on college campuses, and in towns and cities around the world. Jana Palmer reports from New York.
There we go. Other questions?
Horrific. Lauren Kay is sitting with a group of clients, women looking for dates. Kay is the founder and CEO of Dating Ring, a matchmaking company.
So she'll send you one match a week, and you get connected directly.
She founded her company the day after reading Lean In, the best-selling book by Sheryl Sandberg, Facebook's chief operating officer. In the book, Sandberg urges women to aim high in their professional goals and discusses why there are so few women leaders at the top. Kay says that reading the book gave her the push she needed to start her company, and it has stuck with her.
I feel like my friends and I and my teammates and I make Lean In reference/jokes like every day.
As the leader of your company and you're meeting with investors regularly, how do the things in Lean In apply to your life now?
It's definitely something my co-founder Emma and I discuss a lot of exactly how we're going to present ourselves at meetings. You have to be nice, but you also have to be really confident. That's hard, knowing how to walk into a meeting 5 feet tall and look really confident, but also not look arrogant, especially being 25 and walking to a meeting of 100 investors.
In the book, leaning in is defined as essentially women pursuing their ambitions at work. But Lean In has been far from universally embraced.
Is it Jana?
Yes, hi.
Hi, I'm Janet. Hi.
Nice to meet you.
Grab a seat.
Janet Gornick is a professor of sociology and political science at the Graduate Center at the City University of New York. She explained the critiques Lean In has faced.
The main criticism was, this is a book by a privileged woman about privileged women for privileged women. The second criticism was it blames the victim. It puts the onus on women to change their own behavior. The third one was that it ignored public policy. And I think the final line of criticism is people were turned off by her becoming a self-help guru.
In Herald Square, a retail hub in Manhattan, I spoke with Yana Kalu.
I am a student in gender studies and a labor activist in New York City.
She told me she found Lean In disappointing.
It doesn't reflect my experience, and it doesn't reflect the experiences of many of the workers I work with in the grocery store or in the retail sector, in fast food sectors.
I brought this up with Rachel Thomas, the president of LeanIn.org, the nonprofit organization Sandberg founded around the time her book came out. How can a woman making minimum wage, for example, how can she lean in?
I think there's ways that we can all lean in our lives. We know that women are less likely to go for opportunities than men. Research tells us that. We know women are less likely to ask for more than men. I think all women understanding some of those dynamics and how they work can have a really positive impact.
On the 36th floor of a sleek Manhattan office tower, 8 women sit at a conference table, chatting, laughing, eating snacks. For 2 hours, they talk mostly about work.
Well, it sounds like you really enjoyed, you know, the process of setting up a business. And, you know, there's so much, right? It was so much fun.
They aren't coworkers, and they're not old friends. This is a Lean In Circle, one of thousands of peer mentoring groups born out of leanin.org. The women here are mid-career, and when they share with one another, they often get personal.
I walked in to brief my boss on what I was working on, and he told me that they were eliminating my position. It was shocking. It was 2 weeks after my mother died. So it's a lot. It's a lot.
Here, another woman in the group assures her it will all work out for the best.
I agree. I mean, look, I've had a long career doing what I really loved, giving myself a lot of different options so that the next decision feels better. But I don't know yet what that'll be.
There are over 22,000 circles registered with leanin.org. More than originally expected, says President Rachel Thomas.
When we started, we used to say if we had 1,000 lean-in circles, we would be thrilled. That would be success.
The last stop in my lean-in tour was a New York City lean-in chapter event. Several dozen women of varying ages, races, and professions filled the room. I talked with Brenda Berkman, one of the speakers that night.
I'm wearing the captain's dress uniform, so it's an officer's uniform. It has the stripes of my rank.
Berkman was among the very first female firefighters hired in New York City. As she explained in her remarks, she came of age in a very different time.
When I was growing up, women were really not expected to have jobs outside the home. Maybe they would be a nurse, maybe they would...
Today, women make up almost half the U.S. workforce. But until they're in half of leadership positions, Sandberg and her supporters plan to keep leaning in.
Jana Palmer reporting there from New York. Before we go, a reminder that in tomorrow's Business Daily, my colleague Justin Rowlatt takes a last look at the role iron ore plays in the global economy and why its price has collapsed by more than two-thirds over the past 4 years. That's in tomorrow's edition. Until then, do stay tuned with us here on the BBC World Service.